and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
When the coronavirus health crisis hit Dubai this spring, photographer Paola Haney immediately lost all of her jobs. She was not alone. Within weeks, the health crisis closed borders and grounded airplanes in the Persian Gulf city, one of the world's busiest international travel centers. Tens of thousands of foreign workers on temporary visas lost their jobs. To fill her newly free hours, Haney had an idea. She offered free photo shoots to those who are forced to leave the lives they had built in the United Arab Emirates. Haney said she remembered that before COVID-19, families of foreign workers would pay her to take their pictures in front of well-known structures. Here is the Burj Al Arab Hotel, shaped like a sail. Over there is the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building on the planet. If you have been living here for 15 years, she said, you want something to remember it by. Haney said it was crazy. Her phone exploded with texts from people on all forms of social media. When Dubai reopened after lockdown, she spent her mornings on the White Sand Palace beach, photographing over 100 families at sunrise. Most of her subjects are pilots and others who work at Dubai Airport and in the travel industry. They've been here for 15 to 20 years. Their kids were raised here. Then they're sent back home, Haney said. But their home has been Dubai. Darren Chapman is a 49-year-old pilot who came from Greenwich, Connecticut. He met his wife during a stop in Australia 6 years ago. Chapman threw his one-year-old daughter, Harper, into the air as Haney's camera captured the moment. His wife looked on lovingly while the ocean waves washed against the sand. A picture tells the biggest story, and we wanted some memories, Chapman said, for when his daughter grows up. It was our dream to raise her here, he added. We're not too excited to raise her in the States, but it is what it is. The health crisis has been especially damaging to those like Chapman. He piloted one of the Emirates Airbus A380s, the biggest passenger airplanes in the world. The planes are no longer flying without the crowd of travelers. Chapman lost his job after surviving the first 3 rounds of layoffs at state-owned Emirates. He is moving his family to Laguna Hills, California, to find work near his mother and sister. We're quite sad. It is home for us, he said after 11 years in Dubai. Paola Haney, a Brazilian, has lived in the city for 7 years. Even with her own difficulties and uncertain future, she finds solace in helping others say goodbye to Dubai. Everyone is trying to help during COVID, Restaurants are giving food, or people are supporting medical staff, she said. This is my way of helping. I'm Ana Mateo.
U.S. President Donald Trump and his administration have issued more than 400 executive actions that changed America's immigration system. Some of those measures are being discussed in the days before the U.S. presidential election. There were reports that the federal government misplaced information about the parents of 545 migrant children. The parents were separated from their children at the U.S.-Mexico border under a Trump administration policy of zero tolerance for illegal border crossers. The policy was later canceled. Activists working to aid immigrants said they do not know where the children are now or why the parents returned to their countries of origin cannot be found. The children are no longer in the Department of Homeland Security custody, no longer in Health and Human Services custody, no longer in the government's custody, said Lee Gellert. He is with the American Civil Liberties Union, a nonprofit group. They, the children, were sponsored out, and that could mean they are with a relative who maybe they were lucky enough to know. It could be a very distant relative they didn't know, but it could also mean a stranger in a foster family in the United States, Gellert said. The Department of Homeland Security said federal officials have not found a single family that wants their child reunited in their country of origin. Gellert noted that, if found, the parents of the children face a horrible choice of having either be separated permanently or bring their child back to danger in the home countries, rather than bringing the parent back to the U.S. Last year, a federal judge ordered the U.S. government to reunite the children with parents separated under the 2017 program. The program was part of the administration's efforts to limit asylum seeker entry into the United States along the Mexican border. The Supreme Court has set November 30th as the day to hear arguments on the administration's push to remove undocumented immigrants from the U.S. Census count. Census information is used to decide how many U.S. representatives each state has in Congress. Looking to the next year, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear two cases involving policies at the U.S.-Mexico border. One is about the Trump administration's decision to move federal money to pay for part of a border wall. Trump promised to build such a wall in his 2016 election campaign, but Congress, which controls public spending, refused to give him any money. The second case relates to the administration's Remain in Mexico program. It forced asylum seekers to await a decision on their U.S. immigration court cases on the Mexican side of the border. Recently, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security proposed a rule that blocks some groups of individuals from getting asylum. The rule would bar those jailed for a crime and those who have been found guilty of illegal reentry into the United States. I'm Susan Shand.
Imagine you are listening to music in English. Perhaps you hear a few words from something performed by the Beatles. You might wonder about the title or name of the song. The word something belongs to a group of words known as expanded indefinite pronouns. We will explore some of these terms today, but first, let us begin with a few definitions. In another everyday grammar program, we reported on expanded indefinite pronouns. Expanded indefinite pronouns are words that end in thing, body, or one. Examples include something, anybody, everyone, or nothing. Make sure you read our earlier story if you have questions about how native speakers make such words. Many English learners face a problem when trying to use expanded indefinite pronouns. It is unclear how native English speakers use these unusual pronouns, especially when they appear in negative or affirmative sentences. Negative sentences have the word no, not, or sometimes another negative word, such as never. Affirmative sentences are statements that have a positive meaning. They generally do not have a negative word. In general, the negative word determines or decides the pronoun that is used. Let us explore this idea in more detail. English speakers often use expanded pronouns with some in affirmative sentences, as in, would you like something sweet to eat?
Yes, I would like something sweet.
But expanded pronouns with the word any often appear in negative sentences, as in, did you see something?
No, I didn't see anything.
Or, did you see somebody?
No, I didn't see anybody.
Take our earlier example about sweets. Imagine how the sentence would change if it were negative. Would you like something sweet to eat?
No, thanks. I don't feel like anything sweet.
In general, English speakers use expanded pronouns with the word no in statements that do not have another negative word. In other words, sentences with pronouns such as nothing, no one, or nobody rarely, if ever, have other negative terms such as no or never. Imagine you are watching an American crime show on television. Perhaps the police are questioning a suspect. What did you see?
I saw nothing.
But if the suspect used another negative word, the sentence would change as in, what did you see?
I didn't see anything.
Our final expanded indefinite pronouns today begin with the word every. Such words are flexible, meaning they can appear in affirmative or negative sentences. Here are a few examples.
I spoke to everyone. I didn't speak to everyone. I agreed with everything she said. I didn't agree with everything she said.
Remember that you might hear native speakers use expanded indefinite pronouns in different ways. The goal of this report was to give you an idea of how English speakers often use such pronouns. Our goal was not to tell you how native speakers always use these pronouns. At the beginning of this report, you heard part of Something by the Beatles. The next time you watch a TV show or a movie in English, try to listen for examples of expanded indefinite pronouns. Listen to how and when the speakers use each pronoun. In other words, pay attention to these words in the same way that the Beatles were paying close attention to the woman in the song. With time, patience, and repetition, you might one day think to yourself, there is nothing too difficult about these pronouns. Or maybe, I cannot think of anything easier than English grammar. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln won the presidential election in November of 1860. When he took office several months later, he faced the most serious crisis in American history. The Southern states had finally acted on their earlier threats. They had begun to leave the Union over the issue of slavery. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant talk about this critical time in American history.
The Southern states did not want Abraham Lincoln to win the election of 1860. Lincoln was a Republican, and the Republican Party opposed slavery. Lincoln never said he wanted to end slavery in the South. He did not believe anyone had the right to do so. Yet he did not want to see slavery spread to other parts of the United States. Lincoln told Southerners, "You think slavery is right and should be extended, while we think it is wrong and should be limited. That, I suppose, is the trouble. It surely is the only important difference between us."
Pro-slavery extremists felt this difference was enough, and they were sure Lincoln and his Republicans would soon win control of Congress and the Supreme Court. Before long, they thought, the Constitution would be changed. Slavery would become illegal everywhere. Even if this did not happen, Southerners were worried. Unless slavery could spread, they said, the slave population in the South would become too large. In time, blacks and whites would battle for control. One or the other would be destroyed. So, even before the presidential election, Southerners began discussing what they would do if Abraham Lincoln won.
Early in October, the governor of South Carolina, William Gist, wrote letters to the governors of other Southern states. He said they should agree on what action to take if Lincoln became president. Gist said South Carolina would call a state convention as soon as the election results were made official. If any state decided to leave the Union, he said, South Carolina would follow. if no other state decided to leave, then South Carolina would secede by itself. Governor Gist received mixed answers. Two states, Alabama and Mississippi, said they would not secede alone, but they said they would join others that made this decision. Two more states, Louisiana and Georgia, said they would not secede unless the North acted against them. And one state, North Carolina, said it had not yet decided what to do. No Southern governor, except William Gist of South Carolina, seemed willing to lead the South out of the Union.
Abraham Lincoln was elected president on November 6, 1860. South Carolina exploded with excitement at the news. To many of the people there, Lincoln's victory was a signal that ended the state's ties to the Union. To them, it was the beginning of Southern independence. Both United States senators from South Carolina resigned. So did a federal judge and the collector of federal taxes. United States flags were lowered. State flags were raised in their place. The state legislature agreed to open a convention on December 17th. The convention would make the final decision on leaving the Union. Several other Southern states did the same.
This idea of leaving the Union, secession, split North and South just as much as slavery. Southerners claimed they had the right to secede peacefully. Northerners disagreed. They said secession was treason. They said it would lead to civil war. In the months before Lincoln's inauguration, President James Buchanan tried to deal with the situation. First, he proposed a convention of all the states. The purpose of the convention would be to work out differences between North and South. The Southern members of Buchanan's cabinet rejected this idea. The second proposal was a strong policy statement on secession. The statement would include an opinion by the Attorney General. It said the government could use force, if necessary, to keep states in the Union. The Southern cabinet members rejected this idea, too.
President Buchanan had to settle for a moderate policy statement on secession. It said the president could send troops into a state to help federal marshals enforce the rulings of federal courts. But if federal judges resigned, there would be no federal court rulings to enforce. Therefore, to send troops to a state where federal officers had resigned, such as South Carolina, would be an act of war against the state, and only Congress had the constitutional power to declare war. Buchanan accepted this statement. He was only too happy to let Congress decide what to do.
There was little chance that Congress could do anything. Congressmen from both North and South already had made decisions that could not and would not be changed easily. Most of the congressmen from states in the Deep South supported secession. They did not want to remain in the Union. Many congressmen from states in the North had been elected because they promised to keep slavery from spreading to the Western territories. They did not plan to break their promises. A few lawmakers hoped President Buchanan, in his yearly message to Congress, might propose a compromise.
Buchanan began by denouncing Northern abolitionists. He said they were responsible for the present problem. Their interference, he said, had created a great fear of slave rebellions in the South. Then Buchanan called on the South to accept the election of Abraham Lincoln. He said the election of a citizen to the office of president should not be a reason for dissolving the Union. Buchanan declared that the Constitution gave no state the right to leave. But, he admitted, if a state did secede, there was little the federal government could do. The fact is, Buchanan said, that our Union rests upon public opinion. It can never be held together by the blood of its citizens in civil war. If it cannot live in the hearts of its people, then it must one day die.
Buchanan proposed to Congress that it offer a constitutional amendment on the question of slavery. He said the amendment should recognize the right to own slaves as property in states where slavery was permitted. It should protect this right in all territories until the territories became states. And it should end all state laws that interfered with the return of escaped slaves to their owners. No one liked President Buchanan's message to Congress. Northerners did not like his declaration of federal weakness in the face of secession. Southerners did not like his declaration that secession was unconstitutional. The message did nothing to change the situation. Soon after it was read to Congress, South Carolina opened its secession convention.
Delegates to the convention would make the final decision if South Carolina would remain in the Union or secede. There was little question how they would vote. A committee wrote a secession resolution. The resolution said simply that the people of South Carolina were ending the agreement of 1788, in which the state had approved the Constitution of the United States. It said the Union, existing between South Carolina and the United States of America, was being dissolved. The committee offered the resolution to the convention on December 20th, 1860. There was no debate. The delegates voted immediately. No one voted against it.
South Carolina had seceded. But what must it do now? There was the problem of property in South Carolina owned by the federal government. The convention continued to meet to work out details of South Carolina's new position in the world.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.